You will hear two recordings and you have to answer questions on what you hear. There will be time for you to read questions and instructions. All recordings will be played twice. The test involves two parts. There are 5-second pauses between two times of each part and a 1-minute pause between two parts. Now turn to part one.
Language is more than a collection of words and sounds. It is an essential part of a culture that helps not only with communication, but is a reminder of a culture's heritage. It can give us a valuable insight into the beliefs and the way a group of people think, in the same way ancient monuments give us insight into the past. Currently, the UNESCO Atlas of World Languages believes that there are 575 languages that are in danger. This includes languages that have just a handful of speakers, such as Yagan in Chile and Ainu in Japan, but also some languages where there are still thousands of speakers. For example, it's estimated that there are around 170,000 speakers of Navajo, but the language is still in danger as younger generations are not learning it. So, why are so many languages dying out? Why are fewer people learning the languages of their ancestors? One explanation is globalization. When a language becomes socially, politically, and economically stronger than a native language, we often see displacement. The stronger language will dominate at the expense of the so-called weaker ones. One example of this can be seen in East Africa, where Swahili is spoken by 100 million people across Tanzania, Mozambique, and Kenya. In other words, it has become the lingua franca for this pocket of Africa, and in particular the language of business for these nations. This has led to other languages in the region coming close to extinction. By extension, it'll probably become the language of art and culture as technology increases in the region. Another factor of globalization that affects language is the movement of people. As people move to other countries to find work and education possibilities, immigrant parents tend to be less likely to teach their children the language and customs from the old country. However, it's not clear if this is because these parents are driven by concerns about theirs and their children's integration into the new culture and local language, or just that, as immigrants, they may have to work hard to establish themselves and not have the time to teach their children. Nevertheless, there are some ways in which languages that may have died out in the past are being saved, and this is thanks to the globalization and technology that have threatened languages in the past. For example, Joshua Hinson, a member of the Chickasaw tribe in North America, was concerned about the fact that the tribe members who could speak the language well were getting older and the younger members were not interested. He therefore developed an app that taught the Chickasaw alphabet and language. This was a great success with the younger members, and they formed a youth speaking language club and are partnering with language experts to produce a complete course which they hope to make available in the near future. Language is more than a collection of words and sounds. It is an essential part of a culture that helps not only with communication, but is a reminder of a culture's heritage. It can give us a valuable insight into the beliefs and the way a group of people think, in the same way ancient monuments give us insight into the past. Currently, the UNESCO Atlas of World Languages believes that there are 575 languages that are in danger. This includes languages that have just a handful of speakers, such as Yagan in Chile and Ainu in Japan, but also some languages where there are still thousands of speakers. For example, it's estimated that there are around 170,000 speakers of Navajo, but the language is still in danger as younger generations are not learning it. So, why are so many languages dying out? Why are fewer people learning the languages of their ancestors? One explanation is globalization. When a language becomes socially, politically, and economically stronger than a native language, we often see displacement. The stronger language will dominate at the expense of the so-called weaker ones. One example of this can be seen in East Africa, where Swahili is spoken by 100 million people across Tanzania, Mozambique, and Kenya. In other words, it has become the lingua franca for this pocket of Africa, and in particular the language of business for these nations. This has led to other languages in the region coming close to extinction. By extension, it'll probably become the language of art and culture as technology increases in the region. Another factor of globalization that affects language is the movement of people. As people move to other countries to find work and education possibilities, immigrant parents tend to be less likely to teach their children the language and customs from the old country. However, it's not clear if this is because these parents are driven by concerns about theirs and their children's integration into the new culture and local language, or just that, as immigrants, they may have to work hard to establish themselves and not have the time to teach their children. Nevertheless, there are some ways in which languages that may have died out in the past are being saved, and this is thanks to the globalization and technology that have threatened languages in the past. For example, Joshua Hinson, a member of the Chickasaw tribe in North America, was concerned about the fact that the tribe members who could speak the language well were getting older, and the younger members were not interested. He therefore developed an app that taught the Chickasaw alphabet and language. This was a great success with the younger members, and they formed a youth speaking language club and are partnering with language experts to produce a complete course which they hope to make available in the near future.
Part 2.
Monica, welcome to the programme. Your book, Make Your Garden Unique, has been a great success. But why would people want to buy a book about gardening instead of just buying some plants and putting them in the ground?
Hello. Well, yes, I think that's what most people do when they move into a place. There's often little time to think. Lots of readers have written to me saying that's what they've done. Gone to a garden centre, spent a lot of money on seeds and plants, with not very good results. In fact, I think people with that sort of experience make up the majority of my readers.
So, how did your interest in gardening start? Were your parents keen gardeners?
Well, people imagine I must come from a family of gardeners. In fact, my parents would have much rather seen me developing an interest in sport as they were both water sports teachers. But I was forever catching colds, and that put me off. Seeing me spending hours in the garden showing little interest in the world outside plants was a cause for concern rather than pride for them, though.
And how did you go from gardener to writer?
Well, I did win a short story prize at school and enjoyed writing essays at college, but I had no real passion for writing then. I was making a good living looking after gardens. Then, one day, I was working in a nature reserve and I had to write about my day at work for an environmental project. It gave me such a feeling of achievement that when I saw an advert for a gardening journalist on a magazine, I applied, thinking I could do it in my spare time when I wasn't gardening.
And you got the job?
I did, but after a while they made me an editor, which was a kind of promotion. But editors tend to find themselves doing everything but writing, and I'm happiest when being creative, so I decided it was time for a change. My bosses weren't very happy about it, I must say, so I went back to working all hours planting trees and flowers.
And that's when you started writing your book, is that right?
Yes, and I've never looked back, really. I'm now writing my second book about gardens around the world.
So, what makes your gardening book so special for readers?
Well, it takes years of experience to learn to write attractively. It must flow perfectly when you read it, as if it had required no effort at all. But to answer your question, I suppose it's the fact that I'm not merely providing information, because that would make a jolly dull piece of writing. I don't assume everyone's fascinated by gardening, and I include some interviews, the kind of personal experience that may amuse the reader. Of course, the information is all correct and well-researched, but that has to be the case with any serious writer.
Do you choose the photographs for your books?
I do. The quality of photography is excellent now, of course. It's been a fantastic development in that it's brought many more people into gardening. Magazines and books devote a lot of space to photography, and quite rightly. But the pictures often show how things might be rather than how they are. That's my only criticism. The writing's still the important part, though. Readers don't just buy beautiful pictures.
Finally, we've heard you've been asked to take part in a TV programme.
I have, and I'm still thinking about it. The idea is that I'd interview people who've designed some of the most amazing gardens in Europe. It would get me away from my writing routine, which does get a bit too much at times, and it would give me plenty of ideas. It's also true that such a programme can make you into a kind of celebrity, and I'm not sure I'm ready for that, you know. You start being recognised in the street. Although my publisher says that that's something I should be really happy about.
Monica, welcome to the programme. Your book, Make Your Garden Unique, has been a great success. But why would people want to buy a book about gardening instead of just buying some plants and putting them in the ground?
Hello. Well, yes, I think that's what most people do when they move into a place. There's often little time to think. Lots of readers have written to me saying that's what they'd done. Gone to a garden centre, spent a lot of money on seeds and plants, with not very good results. In fact, I think people with that sort of experience make up the majority of my readers.
So, how did your interest in gardening start? Were your parents keen gardeners?
Well, people imagine I must come from a family of gardeners. In fact, my parents would have much rather seen me developing an interest in sport, as they were both water sports teachers. But I was forever catching colds, and that put me off. Seeing me spending hours in the garden showing little interest in the world outside plants was a cause for concern rather than pride for them, though.
And how did you go from gardener to writer?
Well, I did win a short story prize at school and enjoyed writing essays at college, but I had no real passion for writing then. I was making a good living looking after gardens. Then, one day, I was working in a nature reserve and I had to write about my day at work for an environmental project. it gave me such a feeling of achievement that when I saw an advert for a gardening journalist on a magazine, I applied, thinking I could do it in my spare time when I wasn't gardening.
And you got the job?
I did, but after a while they made me an editor, which was a kind of promotion. But editors tend to find themselves doing everything but writing, and I'm happiest when being creative, so I decided it was time for a change. My bosses weren't very happy about it, I must say, so I went back to working all hours planting trees and flowers.
And that's when you started writing your book, is that right?
Yes, and I've never looked back, really. I'm now writing my second book about gardens around the world.
So, what makes your gardening book so special for readers?
Well, it takes years of experience to learn to write attractively. It must flow perfectly when you read it, as if it had required no effort at all. But to answer your question, I suppose it's the fact that I'm not merely providing information, because that would make a jolly dull piece of writing. I don't assume everyone's fascinated by gardening, and I include some interviews, the kind of personal experience that may amuse the reader. Of course, the information is all correct and well-researched, but that has to be the case with any serious writer.
Do you choose the photographs for your books?
I do. The quality of photography is excellent now, of course. It's been a fantastic development in that it's brought many more people into gardening. Magazines and books devote a lot of space to photography, and quite rightly. But the pictures often show how things might be rather than how they are. That's my only criticism. The writing's still the important part, though. Readers don't just buy beautiful pictures.
Finally, we've heard you've been asked to take part in a TV programme.
I have, and I'm still thinking about it. The idea is that I'd interview people who've designed some of the most amazing gardens in Europe. It would get me away from my writing routine, which does get a bit too much at times, and it would give me plenty of ideas. It's also true that such a programme can make you into a kind of celebrity, and I'm not sure I'm ready for that, you know. You start being recognised in the street. Although my publisher says that that's something I should be really happy about.